movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident. Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kiev, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the Constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and Constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
Vraiment, il faut que cette guerre-là, elle cesse.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Programme has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate healthcare and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
A lot of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Millions of Indian Muslims have marked the end of the fasting month of Ramadan with Eid ul-Fitr. In India's capital, New Delhi, large congregations gathered for the morning prayers at major mosques across the city. A local resident there told me the message of Islam is love, affection, and humanity. He said he had dedicated his prayers to the Palestinians in Gaza, who are witnessing Israeli brutalities on a daily basis.
We pray to Allah to give more patience to Palestinians. The situation they are facing is unfortunate, but they are brave people who have time and again proved that the most powerful countries in the world can't break their resolve. They are determined to fight for their right to their land and stand against injustice with a strong faith. Let's pray collectively and hope this day brings an end to their miseries.
Eid was celebrated on Wednesday in the densely Muslim populated state of Kerala, Ladakh and Kashmir, where worshippers held exclusive prayers for the people of Gaza, while emphasizing the unity of Muslims across the globe.
I urge the entire Muslim community around the world to pray fervently for the people of Palestine, who have faced tremendous injustice and oppression. Allah is sufficient for them, no matter how hard the oppressors cause them pain and harm. They should not lose their faith in God. They will emerge victorious sooner or later, since they are fighting against injustice and for a virtuous cause.
Muslims in India reminded the world of their commitment to the Palestinian cause and stressed the importance of collective responsibility and compassion. In recent weeks, activists and rights groups in India have expressed outrage over the UN's failure to stop the Israeli genocide. They called for an all-out economic boycott against Israel to end the regime's brutalities against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Since the beginning of Israeli genocide in Gaza, protest gatherings have been barred in India. Many mosque imams have also been warned not to mention Palestine in their ceremonies by the law enforcement agencies. Islamic scholars say praying for the victims of oppression is an integral part of Islamic belief. They condemn the Western attitude to regime's genocide as hypocrisy, urging for an end to bloodshed. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Quds Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the US-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against US imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna march.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina, who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice, at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the US-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
March 12th, 2024. In my opinion, not a day should pass in the Islamic world where an individual fails to recite verses from the Quran. We all need to recite it. I have said this on numerous occasions that we need to read the Quran as much as possible. So recite as much of it as is feasible. Some people read 5 juz. The Quran is divided into 30 juz or equal sections a day, and others read 1 juz a day. Some read 1 hizb, half a juz a day. If you are unable to do that, then at least read 1 page or half a page a day, but make sure you read some of it. The Quran must be recited. In the statement that I made, recitation of the Quran is for the heart of the reciter, but it is not limited to that. Both the reciter's heart and the hearts of the community should be illuminated and enlightened by the recitation of the Quran. Almighty God told His Prophet, "We have sent the Quran in discrete parts so that you may recite it for the people a little at a time." Chapter 17, verse 106. And in numerous other verses, the verses that I have already mentioned, it states that you should also recite it for the people. This is your job. We read the Quran for ourselves at home, but what you do is a higher level. You recite the Quran for other people. This is very valuable. Recognize your worth and appreciate the value of your work.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another important point to consider is the matter of contemplation. The Quran must be read with contemplation. Of course, contemplation has levels. Contemplation involves delving deeply into the Quran's meaning beyond its outward beauty. Its appearance is elegant and its interior is deep. Nahjul Balagha, Sermon 18. This appearance is the beauty of your work, recitation of the Quran, and the words and beauty of the Quran itself. The deep interior is that which is obtained through contemplation. The more you contemplate on, pay attention to, and understand the issues surrounding a verse or a word, the more knowledge and concepts you will learn from it. This is contemplation. It is a blessed book that we have sent down to you so that they may contemplate its signs. Chapter 38, verse 29.
I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. That's
selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
نقيم الدين ولا تتفرق فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
كتاب الله.
Spotlight. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza has transformed the Palestinian coastal sliver into a living hell on earth. Add to that a deafening Western silence regarding the Israeli genocide of Gazans and active U.S. arms deals that contribute to the murder of more civilians, like the sons of Hamas political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll look into the role that the United States is playing and the losses of the Israeli occupation forces and how Israel continues to dodge a ceasefire deal with various excuses with the intent to prolong the aggression. Well, joining us on this edition of the Spotlight, we have activist and political analyst Batu Sobeti joining us from London. And International Action Center Sarah Flounders joining us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Miss Sobeiti in London. Just about every crime imaginable has been committed against the people in Gaza for over 6 months now, from forced displacement to attacking schools and hospitals to famine and a crime of all crimes, of course, genocide. Give us your perspective on why the Israeli regime is acting in this savage manner against the entire civilian population.
Well, Israel's strategy is very clear. You know, create the most unbearable conditions and kill all life in Gaza. They have no idea what to do the day after the ceasefire. They ultimately have no strategy in place. Israeli security officials and politicians of the entity have discussed fully reoccupying Gaza and establishing complete security control, but they cannot do that because they've been unable to weaken the Gazan resistance. They can't accept the one-state solution because that would be a demographic nightmare for Israel. It relishes on the majority Jewish state. And if the Israeli occupation had any power, it would refuse every other solution that's being put by America. You know, currently that is the two-state solution and the Palestinian Authority consolidating its presence in Gaza. Israel sees that as a recipe for another war. The Gazan resistance is stronger and will win the next phase. So Israel is willing to sacrifice soldiers and even forego hostages because it considers this a war of survival and their last chance, ultimately, in which coexistence with the Gazan resistance is impossible. So given the fact that none of these solutions are working, it has no choice but to essentially forego all of Gaza. So its solution, so to speak, is to place the Gazawi under the most unbearable conditions and to make life so unhabitable that the only solution is to displace the people of Gaza, to get the international community, so to speak, to absorb them as refugees in the same way that it's been systemically doing since 1948. But what I would say is, given the population density of Gaza, the impracticability of displacing them, the international outrage at the occupation entity, the fortitude of the Gazans, most importantly, and that of the resistance, all of these solutions that Israel has in mind is ultimately built on illusions.
Right. Sarah Flounders, 189 days of relentless death and destruction. It's clear now that the Israeli war is not just on the resistance, but it's on all of the people of Gaza, isn't it?
Yes, and I couldn't agree more with the previous speaker, but this is total war against the whole population, particularly targeting the civilian population, because they are unable to reach, they're unable to defeat the resistance forces. So it's an effort to make the war on the civilians, particularly on the children, so horrendous that it demoralizes the Palestinian resistance. That hasn't happened. So really what's happening is Israel is facing a defeat and is thrashing about like a dying animal, without any regard for world opinion, without any regard even for its own future. It's staring complete defeat in the face because they've been unable to defeat the resistance. And they claimed going in that they would wipe out the resistance. They would never allow Hamas to govern again. This was the elected government in Gaza. They are in every way attempting to widen the war as another sort of failed effort to make the cost so horrendous. And yet, step by step, it moves forward. So whether it's in Yemen or whether it is in Lebanon or in Syria, Iraq, all the surrounding countries, it's clear that there is total support for the struggle in Gaza, and they can't reach the Gaza resistance, nor can they stop that fight. So no matter how many terrible weapons and crimes they commit, and it seems like there's a new crime each day that is so impossible even to picture that they would do this, they would plow whole bodies with earth movers in front of cameras, that they would kill all the patients and doctors and medical staff of hospitals. You just can't, that they would bomb a consulate. You know, you can't imagine any of these crimes taking place, except that it shows a complete enraged frustration. Their whole plan was to totally disregard, bypass the Palestinians, and here they're being defeated every day, and the whole world is watching it.
Mr. Leahy, lack of food and essential nutrients in the Gaza Strip is causing death among children and newborns. Even the International Court of Justice has said famine has now turned from a risk into a chronic crisis for the civilian population in Gaza. How is fighting Hamas in any way tied to inducing famine and hunger on Palestinian children in Gaza?
Right. It's precisely because they cannot weaken the Gazan resistance, ultimately, that they resort to these activities. You know, suppose Israel did manage to weaken the Gazan resistance. You know, ultimately, the equation that governs the unity of the fronts within the resistance axis will not allow the resistance in Gaza to fall. And ultimately, that's when you would see that full-fledged intervention from Lebanon and other countries like Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Right now, the resistance axis is supporting Gaza, but that full-fledged intervention will come about if the Gazan resistance is weakened. But the reality is, it's not been weakened, and it's still standing strong. The occupation entity is unable to achieve a single strategic military objective on the ground. They're unable to locate the hostages. Even if they did, they're unable to take them out. You know, they're unable to locate or reach the location of the Gazan resistance to assassinate its leaders within Gaza. It's only managed to assassinate leaders like Aruri outside of Gaza. So they get brave with the family of Ismail Haniyeh, you know, his children. And that ultimately has no crucial effect or bearing on the situation on the ground. The infrastructure of the resistance is still very much intact. As we mentioned previously, the occupation entity is unable to reoccupy Gaza. All of its ground invasions have failed, and most recently it's been forced to withdraw from Khan Yunis after sustaining immense losses. So the occupation entity as a whole is lost. You know, internally it's fractured. You know, the Haredi Jews that don't want to be conscripted, that's going on. You know, you have the entity that is complaining about not having enough soldiers that want to fight. Their morale is very low. You know, even pre-October the 7th, you had 300,000 reserve force fighters who were actually, you know, striking, you know, in protest over the occupation entity's governmental laws. You know, the people on the streets ultimately want to see an end to this war because they deem it as a failure. They want to see the release of the hostages. So Israel's only plan right now really is to make life unlivable in Gaza, hoping that they can get the people of Gaza into despair to the extent where they can deport them and finish Gaza off altogether. It wants to finish from the headache of Gaza. You know, that was where the plan to displace them to the Naqab or the Sinai, that's as a result of that. Or, you know, the plan to build that humanitarian port that Israel quickly, the humanitarian port, right, that Israel quickly signaled the positive go-ahead light, ultimately, because that sees it as a route to get the displaced people of Gaza out. But what are the people of Gaza saying? Even if you pay us money to fly on planes and to leave Rafah, we will not do that. Because this is our land, and this is our right, and this is our dignity. We sacrificed so much to get to this point. We will not give up.
Sarah Flounder's outrage grows day by day over Israel's deadly attacks on Gaza aid convoys and aid workers. A UNICEF car came under fire in northern Gaza earlier this week on its way to deliver aid to malnourished children. Also, the United Nations says that it's gravely concerned over the Israeli airstrike that killed seven members of the U.S.-based charity the World Central Kitchen. Why isn't the international community doing more for the aid workers putting their lives on the line? And do you think that it's basically the U.S.'s support that has emboldened the Israelis to get to this point?
Well, to answer the last point first, it's absolutely U.S. support now and decades, 75 years of U.S. support, U.S. open funding, billions and billions of dollars, U.S. weapons investment, money, everything has given a green light to the entire Zionist society to feel they would always have a blank check, that no matter what they did, they would have U.S. support. And Biden reinforced that from the very first day of the war, that regardless of what it took, the U.S. would stand with this creation. If this is a U.S. creation for endless war in the entire region, and they will back up Israel to the limit. So while the UN can make some statements, they're not doing much at all, and they could do much more and have to do much more. And it's really the world movement that has to demand accountability of these international organizations. And I want to say from here in the U.S., we have to do much more, even though every single day there are just in the tens and tens of thousands of people in the streets, especially young people. But the support for Israel has collapsed, and that is something that Israel will never recover from. And every member of the U.S. Congress is now even feeling the pressure, and U.S. corporations and banks that have invested so much money in Israel are feeling the pressure of a mass movement making demands, holding sit-ins and port shutdowns and school closings, one action after the other, extremely creative. But we have to continue that, and we have to actually increase those actions, not just in the staged demonstrations, but in all manner of confrontations that have been going on. I think they're very important, because every one of those actions is a way of saying we refuse to go along with this. Polls now in the U.S., and this is staggering, show that the population, overwhelmingly, the majority of the population is with Palestine. That's amazing when you consider the criminal role that the U.S. corporate media has played every single day in backing up Israel's crimes and in hiding their crimes. And yet, nevertheless, it is seeping through into the population as a whole. So, yes, the U.S. is emboldening Israel, and the mask is off. I think around the world, and even right here in the U.S., and this is also true in Britain and in the EU, there is a recognition of the crimes of their own countries and a demand for accountability. And we have to, as I say, we have to step that up. The idea that aid workers can be attacked with complete impunity again, right, and again and again. These really are unfathomable crimes, and they need to be confronted legally, but also in the streets and in the resistance right here.
Ms. Sobeiti, have all the years of impunity in U.S. cover for Israel made this child-killing regime believe that it is above the law and is safe from accountability? Close to 200 aid workers have been killed in the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. That's the highest number of aid worker deaths ever recorded in any conflict, and that is no accident.
Right. Ultimately, the call last week between Biden and Netanyahu, I believe, was quite significant, because it reiterated how America is actually leading the battle for Israel and will decide on the appropriate action when U.S. strategy is not followed through and actually when U.S. interests become harmed. Israel is a proven failure. Ultimately, from America's perspective, it needs to be put on the side, and political action needs to take its course. That is beginning with a ceasefire, hostage exchange, in addition to letting aid into Gaza. But ultimately, I do believe right now Israel is no longer safe from a lack of accountability. It's only gotten away with the lack of accountability for all these years because the world had ultimately turned a blind eye. So the West allowed Israel to continually transgress beyond and beyond. But today what we're seeing is there's a real swing in public mood against the occupation entity. It is spanning the whole world. You know, the billion-dollar Israeli lobby is unable to reverse this. And that is unprecedented. And that is ultimately because the events on the ground are to a magnitude that is so large that it overcomes all of the Zionist lobbying efforts. The occupation entity today is in danger of becoming a pariah within global politics. You know, the West has reached a point where it just cannot cover up for Israel's crimes. You know, Israel has been exposed as a rogue entity. And this war ultimately has exposed the masks, you know, and those false values that are advocated by the West. You have world thinkers today that are starting to discuss the inevitability of Israel's demise and its lack of ability to survive in light of its failures. And ultimately, this has everything to do with the pressure that the people, especially in the West, are applying onto their governments to distance them from the occupation entity. Today, we're seeing Europe's lack of enthusiasm to support support Israel. We're seeing bold changes in the official positions of countries like Southern America, you know, Brazil, Colombia, the unprecedented criminalization of Israel through international bodies. So I do firmly believe that the tides are shifting, and especially post-war, we will increasingly see Israel being held to real account. Right now, America's walking with Israel because it's like its injured child, so to speak, and they're waiting for this ceasefire to be invoked so that they can really and truly hold Israel to account for its huge failures.
Sure. Sarah Flounders, the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, he's recently said that freedom-seeking and independent countries need to make a concerted effort to put pressure on Tel Aviv to stop its atrocities. Why aren't regional blocs, and most notably Arab governments, stepping up and taking matters into their own hands? As we know, many officials have called on Muslim and Arab countries to openly express their opposition to Israel and to sever ties with the Israeli regime. Why is that not happening? And how much of the situation today is a result of the complacency of some Arab governments, especially the U.S. allies in the region?
Well, the complacency and really compliance of these governments is based on a completely corrupt agreement made for decades with U.S. power and U.S. money in the region, and U.S. buying off of officials, royal families that are appointed. It really is the whole, that is what is being shaken far beyond Gaza today. That the popular movements, the mass movements, are demanding of their government action and accountability. And these governments are willing to make some paper shows, some photo ops. They're going to send in a few supplies, but of course they're not in any way doing what they could be doing. And this is true for the government of, particularly of Egypt and Jordan, where so much more could be done and is not being done because they've profited. Small groups of people have profited over these criminal arrangements made with the U.S., and they fear losing U.S. support, U.S. money. They have militaries that have been trained by right here at bases in the United States, so they have a whole thread of relations that enchains them, the officials and the military regimes of these countries and several other countries too. So I do think the people of the region are demanding accountability and stepping up their efforts. That will create a change. And that's coming through. And it's what there is such fear on the part of U.S. officials that this could all break apart. They have spent so much over many decades creating this web to keep the whole region down and compliant and colonialized, or there's neo-colonialism, as we would say, Israel making a direct colony in Palestine, and yet these relations that disrupt life internally continue. But they're breaking apart, and they're breaking apart because the population as a whole is united in supporting Gaza, overwhelmingly feeling that recognition. I think the U.S. position globally is shaken as it's never been before. It's amazing. But what is happening on a global basis with many countries around the world, not just in the region, seeing the duplicity, the crimes, and what the U.S. will do to back up its proxy states, seeing how far they would go, is creating a horror. And that's really leading to the undermining of the U.S. position, not only of Israel, but also of U.S. imperialism on a global basis. It's really happening and unthreading.
Mr. Beiti, Iran says Israel's recent attack on its embassy in Damascus, which violated the immunity of diplomatic venues, necessitates legitimate defense with the objective of punishing the aggressor. So Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, he says that punishment here is necessary as Israel has shown total disregard for international law and the Vienna conventions. Do you agree with the Iranian foreign minister's comments? And why would Israel carry out such an attack, which would risk a serious escalation in the region?
Right. The Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate put them in a very bad place. Between direct retaliation and ultimately granting Iran a big opportunity, you know, to be an important party to any solution in favor of the Gazan resistance, there is no doubt that the Iranian response is coming. No matter how big or small it is, depends on the negotiations. And on that basis, I don't think we'll be seeing the response quite soon. Ultimately, though, Iran has the strongest cards. To use this, though, it needs to threaten with the maximum retaliation in a way in which their enemy will calculate and explore all of the potential responses. So here, Iran is giving them an alternative. You know, that is, if you do not wish for maximum penalty, then you have to agree to a ceasefire and compromises that are on the terms of the resistance. So ultimately, this strong Iranian card of retaliation is actually now in the hands of the negotiators of the Gazan resistance. And that's a very strong card. You know, and if this card is walking and the occupation entity withdraws from Gaza completely, you know, recently we saw the withdrawal from Khan Yunis that took place. So if moving forward, you know, they agree on the return of Palestinians to the north, a kind of ceasefire deal is reached, in that case, the direct Iranian response would be limited to smaller targets. It wouldn't be of a threat nature. But I certainly believe that if Iran reaches a deal that establishes a ceasefire, then Iran would have ultimately secured the greater victory. And that is the total defeat of the occupation entity, because the war would have ended with the Gazan resistance still standing. Now, in terms of the trajectory of the war, it is not escalatory, because the resistance is very calculated. They don't get dragged to any square. They account for the higher interest. You know, their goal is for the aggression of Gaza to end, and in the process to establish new deterrence equations. You know, through October the 7th, the Axis managed to secure many points of victory. Perhaps Netanyahu at this current moment doesn't want to avoid the Iranian hit. Perhaps he wants to implicate America along with it. But Netanyahu's stupidity lies where? It's in thinking that he can drag America to something that they don't want. He thinks he can drag America to expanding the war. They think America will get involved if Iran attacks the occupation entity hard enough. But the worst thing for America's position right now in the region is expansion of the war. With every confrontation with the resistance axis, America's standing in the region is weakening. If America was thinking about expanding the war, it would have launched much larger forces into the region. And even if the US were to reallocate its forces regionally in a war with Iran, that would take months of preparation and assembling. So the mobilization of resources for war is politically and militarily unsustainable for the US. The US has no capability nor desire to engage in a wider regional war. To deploy its troops, it would need access to